sorry to be so strong, but you must be able to hear this in its valuation. If we just live by rote, the bad habits which are ingrained in our nature and our civilization will lead karmically to death. There is no way out of that whatsoever. Very short order. Maybe one more generation. The alternative is to act from an awakened inner focus, from the deep self. All of those actions lead to life. So literally, we're given about a generation. Choose whatever you want, but it's life or death. Choose life. But the choice of life first goes in. Awaken that deep self. And then whatever you do, whatever your life expresses from that resonance, in resonance to that deep self, that will lead to life. It may not seem like it from time to time, from day to day, or perhaps even week to week, or maybe even year to year. Although on a year scale, you should be able to see the broadening out towards life. But eventually, you'll be able to see that all of your activities have changed. You have transformed. And your activities are leading to life. And it's only by bringing that life mode into play in this life that there is any future whatsoever for man as a species. Which means then that the crucial area that is here is the area of history. But there can be no history until there are persons who can make that history. And there can be no persons until there is a deep self experience. And there can be no legitimate deep self experience until there is an integration of the fullness of nature and of ritual and of myth. So it all ties together. In the tying together, there is a linchpin which makes all of this development, all of the achievement stay. The linchpin that makes the conscious, artistic, lived life history real is in science. Science is the sealer, the sealing manifestation of that deep self person who makes all of the life energies happen. So that science becomes an ultimate value and is intimately related to the problem of the idea of history. An extremely complex relationship. In a way, the phrase that has come to be all-inclusive and resonant of our situation is that there must be a spiritual science. A spiritual science for the person. And if one could unfold the meaning of that phrase, that would be quite accurate. Quite an accurate statement. There needs to be a spiritual science which the person can live in their life with confidence. Courage. It doesn't mean that it's going to work all the time, but it means that you know that whether it's working or not, this is right. This is the way that leads to life. Whatever resistances, and believe me, there are more resistances now than almost any time since about 2,000 years ago. Even if nothing goes right, you are still on the path to life. That was the old formulation, and I think it still holds. When we come back from the break, we'll talk a little bit more about the temples, but I'd like you to take a look not only at the Greek temple of Apollo in the handout, but the second page is the symbolic temple of the ultimate temple of God from the temple scroll, from the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's an Essene projection of the ultimate temple of God in Jerusalem. And I want you to see the correlation between the temple of Apollo 700 BC and the temple from the temple scroll of the Dead Sea Scrolls in about 125 BC. There is a definite correlation. The temple of Apollo is the first sketch towards what it's supposed to be. The temple in the Dead Sea Scroll is an accurate symbolic mandala of the fullness of that symbolic image. This temple was never built physically, and in fact, for your information, doesn't need to be built physically. The temple in man. But nevertheless, I want you to see that there are historical accuracies. And the 600 years in between these two temple plans is a real development in human consciousness. Let's take a break. We'll get to some of our paintings in just a moment and remember that we have two project assignment things that we're working on. Try and make a painting, just whatever interests you, whatever comes out. If you don't have something in mind, that's fine, just start to play with colors on canvas or paper or something. And try and do this by next week. Try and have your painting with quotation marks here by next week. And then the following week, 2 weeks from today, we'll start with our masks. Now the masks are to be masks of some role that you're forced to play in your life. Or maybe they're not twisting your arm that you have to play in your life. Some aspect of your life that you recognize as a definite role. It's not a derisive quantification. I give you that Yevtushenko poem, Monologue of a Broadway Actress. What would be derisive is if you have to play bit parts all the time and didn't really have a role. Being able to delineate a role in a mask image is a very sophisticated way by which consciousness performs a kind of a jujitsu on your social pattern. It's a time-honored technique. And it's a way of doing what otherwise would be impossible, to lift yourself by your own bootstraps. I'll give you a quotation from David Reisman. We talked about a little bit last week. This is The Lonely Crowd. And Reisman was a very great sociologist, a very great man. He's talking about, in his introduction, about the structure of his book and what it's about, why he's writing it. And he says, part two suggests that for the more privileged classes in America, it is probably as important to feel free as to be free. This was written in 1949, and now it's true of almost everyone in a world culture. It's not important to be free. It's important to feel free. So you don't need to work for Nirvana if you can get a hit on drugs or something. But this is not a life path. This is a death path. Sure as all get out. He writes, part three attempts to come to grips with the practical implications and limitations that approach to life and politics. It begins with the essential psychological and philosophical postulate that adjustment, that's with quotation marks, adjustment, no matter how comfortable it appears to be, is never freedom. Beyond adjustment to the prevailing mode of conformity, beyond obedience to or fascination by the peers, lies the possibility of autonomy. Autonomy arises when men use the opportunity presented by the, quote, loose fit of social character, which is never all of character. The role, a role that you play, is an image of social character. And to be able to differentiate that from you gives the experience of this loose fit, which is the beginnings of the sense of wonder that leads to personal freedom. The first glimmer, the first indication at all, is a sense of irony. And sometimes it comes quiet like a black cat at midnight. And sometimes it's just a guffaw. When you begin to have the feeling-toned insight that there's something beyond what you thought you were. Not just a possibility, but a definite someone who is beyond, outside the pale of who you have been. Now, in a lot of personality profile things from the same time as the Lonely Crowd, they still used to keep, I think, the Minnesota Multifastic personality test. One of the questions always was, do you hear voices? And if you do, our corporation doesn't really want you. Whereas what you need to do is to listen to those voices. That quiet voice, notice the paradoxical symbolic quality, that silent voice within is you, is really you. And you have to learn to listen to it. It's like Thoreau says, he looked strange to most people of his time because he was walking to a different drummer. His whole pace of life was to an eternal deep self and not at all to any kind of a 19th century Concord, Massachusetts role. Even the role of a transcendental philosopher was still a role to someone like Thoreau. And sophisticated, even though that role was, it was still to him a role. Whereas Emerson had problems, he was the Unitarian transcendental minister, and it was very hard for him not to be in that role. And towards the end of his life, he was caged by that role. He never was free. John Muir, in his diaries someplace, records the momentous occasion when he met the old Emerson up in the Sierra Nevadas, Yosemite. And he said all his life he looked forward to being able to sleep outdoors with a natural sage like Emerson under the open sky of the universe. But as the nightfall came, Emerson's people who were taking care of him and so forth said it was too cold for the man. He was too old. He couldn't sleep outdoors. And they led him into a cabin, and he slept indoors. And Muir said that it was the loneliest night he had ever had in his entire life, that night of sleeping alone under the stars, because he knew that even someone like Emerson had been finally caged, and a free spirit was no longer really there. So there are poignancies indeed. So the mask that you're to make is a mask of some role, and you're making the mask to differentiate that role from your deeper self, from the more comprehensive person who you are. And if you have to use a strong term, you're going to exorcise the fascination of some phony model of you from yourself. Now, it's better to do it in a situation like this and just do it in a kind of a friendly, educational way than to have to come to grips with that kind of a threshold. And if you're going to ever grow and be free, you have to come to grips with that. It's better to do it educationally than to have to kick it free with your last desperate gasp. That happens. It happens more often than anyone would expect you to believe. The classic story of how that happens archetypally was written by the old Leo Tolstoy. And it's his story, The Death of Ivan Illich. And if you want, you can read The Death of Ivan Illich. It's about 15 pages, 20 pages, and you can see this is what happens. The old rich judge Ivan Illich, as he gets more infirm, realizes that his world is shrinking. He can't go places he used to go. He can't do things he used to do. His world shrinks and shrinks until finally he realizes he's trapped in his bedroom. And finally he realizes he's never going to leave bed alive. This is it. And begins to experience himself as a big, dark, black hole that he's trying not to fall into, but as his world is shrinking, there's nothing left but that black hole. But because Tolstoy, in his old age, was a deeply compassionate man, he showed a way out. But nevertheless, it's an existential trigger that's there in the life pattern. If you do it in this way now, in an educational way, it's a part of your growth. It's an organic part of your life. You'll never experience a trauma about it. It may be difficult, but that's quite distinct from a trauma. It's better to get educated about it than to have to desperately try to find some way to kick yourself free at the last gasp. Coward dies 10,000 times. The courageous die but once and live again. Now I want to give you a couple of things about the Greek temple, just so that you can have this on cassette for yourself. Here's a collection of essays on Greek religion and society, published by Cambridge University Press in paperback. One of the essays is by a classical scholar, a good one, J.N. Coldstream, Greek Temples, Why and Where. And he has just a couple of these sentences which we need to hear. After the collapse of the Mycenaean civilization and after the destruction of its palaces around 1200 BC, that is to say, the Trojan War, the destroying of Troy was symbolic of a whole civilized threshold of crisis. It is only that Troy was destroyed, every Cretan palace, every Mycenaean palace, every Minoan palace was destroyed in that generation. They were all ransacked and burned and tore up. The kings were killed, their children killed. After the collapse of the Mycenaean civilization and after the destruction of its palaces around 1200 BC, traces of domestic religion disappear. Religion had once been in the home, and you don't find it. The archaeological record is quite clear. From time immemorial, religion had been the center of the home. The domestic life. The altars were in the home. And in the Dark Ages of preceding classical Greece, that whole phenomenon disappears. it's like an agnosticism or an atheism at the very center of social life just swept over everything. To put it colloquially, nobody gave a shit about anything. Nothing was done. Nothing happened. During the ensuing Dark Age, it seems that all worship took place in the open air, usually around a fixed and raised altar for burnt sacrifices. And then, suddenly, in the great dawn after the Dark Age, in the 8th century BC, 700 BC, the freestanding temple emerges as a new architectural form. But this does not mean that religious worship then went indoors. On the contrary, the open-air altar in most places remained the focus of the cult. As a general rule, the temple was never a place for congregational worship, like a synagogue or a Christian church. It was simply the house of the god, the place where the god's image resided. Why then should it have been during the 8th century that the Greek temple has its origin? Its appearance coincides with many other symptoms of a great awakening after the Dark Age, and it has been reasonably claimed that the building of a freestanding temple was one of the first corporate enterprises of the emergent city-state. Doubtless there are other important signs for the arrival of the true polis, the true city, not the least the construction of massive fortification walls and the provision of a central space for public gatherings. Nevertheless, a broad historical point can be made with regard to the first temples. If we bear in mind the political changes between Mycenaean and archaic times, the change from monarchy to aristocracy, and eventually to constitutional government, the corporate effort which had once gone into the building of palaces and royal tombs was now diverted to the service of building the temple for the god and the city of man who lives under the rule of that god. So there is a radical change. Now, Coldstream's essay on Greek religion and society is just reiterating what had become quite apparent in classical studies by that time. I think this book came out in 1986 or so, 85. The first person to ever understand this phenomenon was named Vincent Scully, not the Dodger broadcaster, you sly devils. Not Vin Scully, but Vincent, as in Vincent Van Gogh Scully. And his great book came out and was published by Yale University Press in 1962. So the original realization of this actually is quite recent. The Earth, the Temple, and the Gods, Greek Sacred Architecture. And I believe it's in paperback, and you can find copies at Hennessy and Ingalls. And on the cover of the original first edition, which I have here, it shows a Greek landscape, which looks very much like Southern California, but right in the middle of it, in the photograph, is the beautiful white columns of a temple, a Greek temple. And it's like a way of saying that in the center of nature, man puts something which only he can see belongs there. A symbol of his divine inner realization in the landscape. And you can see what a powerful thing this was 2,700 years ago. It's not the same as someone like Hatshepsut building the temple, her tomb along the Nile across from Thebes. It's not the same thing. It's not a palace. It's not a tomb. This is a temple for not some god that's out there, but for a feeling resonance that one knows is in you. This building is the bell to contain that resonance, that inner resonance. So that every time you go to that temple, you strike that bell of your expression, and it reminds you of what you once felt in a high moment. And the remembrance of it recreates that in you. So that going to the temple, presenting yourself on a day, a commemorative day, in the annual cycle, in the natural cycle, in the ritual cycle, in the mythic cycle, there would have been a day when you presented yourself before God to experience again that complete resonance, the expression and manifestation of which was this temple which you had built. Not just you, but the whole social structure within which you lived shared that symbolic vision. You could see that the Gothic cathedral is very much like the Greek temple. The Gothic cathedral coming again at the end of a dark age. Just like the Greek temple came at the end of a dark age, coming out of a morass, an inner morass, a confusion, and coming out in a way of understanding there is something we need to do together. We need to make together a manifestation, an expression of our shared presence of God. And that's what this is. That's what this temple is now. Or that's what that Gothic cathedral is. It doesn't belong to someone. It's not owned by a king. It's the community sacrifice through industriousness and intelligence to provide a place to remind them that God is here. It's like Chartres Cathedral. As soon as it was built the first time, it burned to the ground. And the people that had taken some 90 years to build it simply got to work again and spent another 70 years and rebuilt the whole thing. Faith can not only move mountains, but it can cut it up into big stone blocks and place them in exactly the right way and make the house they want to make. God will have his house. It's that kind of symbolic consciousness that distinguishes the conscious society from the lower level, if we can say, of just a kind of a tribal instinctual life. There's nothing wrong with the instinctual life when you're in a tribe, but when you're a conscious individual, you can't go back and go native. Because the whole structure of the psychic energy has transformed. Once it's transformed, it is different. The supernatural now is real. The ghosts are not out there in the jungle, they're in you. And you have to deal with them inside, and not as if they were still out there in the jungle. The aliens are not on some other planet. They're in your psyche. And whether or not there are beings on other planets, they are not aliens. By the time you can interface with them, what is home to you will be whole star systems, and they won't be aliens at all. Beings together. The only aliens there are the aliens within. And they are there. Now, Vincent Scully in chapter 4 says this, and I'll just give you this because these are classic words about the Greek temple. A decisive gulf divides the latest Mycenaean Megara. These buildings were not called temples, but in Greek, Megara. A decisive gulf in intention divides the last Mycenaean Megara from the earliest Greek temples. In other words, if one takes all the archaeological record, the architectural record, and you were able to lay it out in a chronological development, lay it out on a long table, here are the examples, here are the dates, and they're all in order, there is a gulf, there's a break, there's a discontinuity, there is a quantum jump from the last of the one and the beginning of the other. It's just like in an electromagnetic spectrum, there are quantum jumps. This is an energy jump. There's no continuity. It's an indication that some other activity other than a natural continuity is operating. What is it? It's a symbolic integration. It's an eternal moment that has come into play that wasn't in play before. Or if it was in play, wasn't responded to, and now it is responded to. It's a quantum jump. So much so that the human beings who grew up and became used to the consciousness of the Greek temple completely forgot about the old Mycenaean Minoan age. The figures who had been real, like Agamemnon or like Zeus, who had been persons before, were now just mythic images. And to talk about them was to talk about mythology, not about history. One has to be able to develop very, very, very sophisticatedly to be able to recapture that past historically. Because one has to go into the deep self enough to become familiar with it so that those quantum jumps are no longer gulfs of incomprehension, but they are in fact energy jumps, of which there are many, not just one. But you're able to incorporate that into your perspective. You're able to see large enough to see, indeed. In my own life, one sees, yes, there have been quantum jumps. The reason why I couldn't remember so accurately before what happened on June 3rd when you were 8 years old. One can remember exactly with indelible accuracy if one is in useful, familiar contact with your deep self. It's like those are the first symbolic past lives. The previous selves that you had, the previous roles that you had, do you remember? That's remembering past lives. The ways that you were, which you had slipped into unconsciousness. You didn't know. You didn't remember. All you had were feeling-toned mythic traces. And in a very real way, in a mystical way, the realization of the full deep self is the realization of the eternal self. It has never died. It has never not been. There's no such thing, ultimately, as a past life. There's only one life, which has many facets. Scully writes, a decisive gulf in intention divides the last Mycenaean Megara from the earliest Greek temples. Many centuries separate them, about four, and many complex developments in thought at which we today can merely guess. Initially, an enormous cataclysm brought a dark age. Into the domains of the Bronze Age lords burst the hardy Dorian tribesmen, equipped or soon to equip themselves with iron swords and riding horses. Swords of iron and horses were the powerful symbolic images around which this new energy of deconstruction, which characterized the Dark Age, was made of. Just to say graphically, the elegant royal Bronze Age warriors with the bronze helmets and the bronze spears and the bronze chariots, the bronze shields. They would hold an elegant bronze shield up and an iron sword would crash right through it and split it in half and hack the arm off. An iron sword was ever so much stronger than bronze. The elegant effete Bronze Age prince would elegantly sweep with his bronze sword and the barbarian with the iron sword would split it in half. It was a no contest. And the whole bronze gleaming civilization of elegant royalty came crashing down from these ruffians who rode horses and had iron swords. So with the image, the mythic image, of the man on the horse, of the centaur, became one of the mythic images of this devastating quality. What was it devastating? It was devastating the whole life vision that had once been the very fabric of life. So there are many of these aspects that I just want to acquaint you with. You don't have to become scholars of this, and you don't have to know the whole story, but you do have to be aware that there are currents and patterns and events, and there is a consciousness which can understand it all and keep track of it all, and that consciousness of the full vision is founded upon the soul, founded upon the psyche, and that the soul is not a thing, it is an inner focus. What is it a focus of? It is a focus of all the values, of all the meanings that you generate. So if you only generate two or three values, you have a little bit of soul. If you generate several thousand, you have a pretty good soul. You have a pretty good focus to deal with. And if you run into asymptotic trillions, then you have a very comprehensive soul, very comprehensive psyche. Whatever you put into it, that's all that's there. It's like the recipe book. You don't get anything out of the oven that you didn't put in the recipe in the first place. So the whole thing is not to have somebody give you an idea of the soul, but to give you experience in the kitchen of life so that you can get better and better recipes, so that you can generate the values that you'd like to have, generate the meaning that you would like to have, and enrich your life, enrich your ritual comportment and your mythic capacity, make more powerful your symbolic focus. Then the person that comes out of that will really be somebody. Well, I'm going to go next week into Frank Lloyd Wright, because Wright is the architect in our time who's like the builder of the first Megara, the first Greek temple. He's like a builder like those builders who began the Gothic cathedrals. He's an individual, and a protean individual at that. Now, if you can get it, Frank Lloyd Wright, Writings and Buildings. I think it's still in print and paperback. And the sections that I would like you to take a look at, on 84, the section is called The Sovereignty of the Individual. And on page 172, Taliesin, which was the name of his own house. And 3, beginning on page 197, is The Imperial Hotel. So I want to have Wright talking about the individual, the sovereign self, and then about his own home, Taliesin, building his home, and then about the first challenge outside of his cultural milieu, which was in Japan. He had a personal invitation from the emperor to build just outside of the palace grounds in Tokyo, the royal grounds there in Tokyo, to build the Imperial Hotel, which was meant to be a Japanese royal state function place to bring foreigners from all over the world into Japan to meet Japan in terms of an international scene, but also in terms where the Japanese values would be kept alive. And Wright saw that this was an epical problem in architecture, and he accepted the commission, and he had to live in Tokyo for 6 years in order to do it. And the Imperial Hotel is a world-class building, even though it's physically gone now. It was a resolution in art of a deep self-integration which Frank Lloyd Wright as a person was able to handle. In other words, he made himself personally the fulcrum of a deep self-integration in an artistic manifestation. Between the deep self and the building was the man. And he balanced them both and brought the expression into play in a way which has rarely been done ever in history. And the Imperial Hotel hopefully in the next century will be rebuilt in many places in the world, because it's an example of exactly how a universal artistic genius using the deep self as the origin of his vision is able to bring the whole project off. So try and do that if you can. Now let's go to your paintings. And I don't know how we can do this. Maybe set up a chair here, or maybe next to Dan, we'll lean paintings up there. Who has a painting? First one, Walter?
Before I show my painting, I have to make a few prefatory remarks.
Is this a confession?
Because it's a non-event. The project is incomplete. And this will give you a history lesson in how to end the project. I had some problems with this little project, and that I didn't have any art supplies, and I wasn't about to go out to buy any. And I began thinking, what is it that I can do? And I wanted to do as simple a thing as possible. But the simplest things have already been done. The calligraphy of the circle, square, and the triangle, that's here, and whatever it is. So I thought maybe I'll begin with an alphabet. So that's what I did. I didn't have any art supplies, so I figured that I had felt pens, and I was going to do it on felt pens, so I bought a poster board, and I began with it. I had the feeling that I had some inks at home and wanted to provide a wash. So this is how I began the thing. I happen to put the letter A here, and the moment that I had the letter on, I happened to think that, I was going to do a word play between the letter as a member of the alphabet and the letter as a complete statement, a prosaic or a poetic statement. And I was going to add it in here like the calligraphy of... What's the name of the nun sister that does all statements with with all the written words, and you aren't familiar with it? Okay. But anyhow, that's what I was going to do. I was going to edit the statement, so I edited this thing and I put it in the free form, and then on an intuition basis, I began editing these other things in here, and all of this was free. And I said, I'm going to make this statement in here. But before I was going to put the statement in, I was going to add all the ink wash in. And I started this at the beginning of the week, and I was away for a couple of days. And when I got back yesterday afternoon, I said, I'm going to do it in the evening. So I began to start to get out all of the materials that I had. And I discovered I didn't have any ink wash. I have 5 bottles of ink, and they're all black. And I wasn't able to use the ink wash. But I was going to put the statement in here. And I was going to invert the thing. So when I didn't have my ink washes and all, I added in the shape here, my circle, and the triangle, and the square, and then I added in these three shapes in here. And on my way over this morning, I decided that I was going to complete the poetic statement. I plucked the letter from the air and put it on the paper there. Thank you. dubious thing fly off the page and sing, but before the song can come to pass, that ding-a-ling artist must get off his ass.
Thrifty class.
That's about it. That's true.
I like it.
I happen to, that's how I started out, and I was going to invert it. But without the wash, it's washed out.
Yeah. It was well with that little flap up there.
And the reason why, I haven't completed it is that I'm going to be away for a couple of weeks, so the project, won't be able to be shown here.
It's graceful.
Go ahead, Jean.
I see it very vibrant, just ecstatic with color and energy. I see no washout at all. I see it all coming at you and towards you and pushing and swirling together. It's on a cosmic way, maybe I would say, like the star. What's that?